everybody, a warm welcome to another very amazing episode in our podcast series, Everyday Decoloniality, a Multicultural Initiative. And in this episode, we have with us Roberto Hernandez, who is currently working as Associate Professor in Chicana and Chicano Studies at San Diego State University. He is also the chair-elect in National Association for Chicana and Chicano Studies. And today we will be basically engaged with the aspect of decolonizing, decoloniality, and how to demetaphorize it and push it towards more and more praxis in everyday life. So very warm welcome, Roberto.
Thank you for having me.
So what I, through my experiences with the decolonial engagements, decolonial thinking and doing on an everyday basis, what I was wondering is that day by day, as we are engaging more and more with the ideologies of decolonization and decoloniality, one major challenge that we are encountering, at least what I understand from my geopolitical position in India, what we are encountering is the metaphorization of these ideologies. What I mean is, like post-coloniality, decolonization and decoloniality is becoming more of a theoretical construct rather than being in praxis, and is gradually getting hijacked by colonial slash Western and colonialized slash Westernized patterns of thinking and doing. So, as a scholar, as an activist, why do you think this is happening?
I think in part it's tied to the West's obsession with novelty, right? That is, with newness for newness' sake. There's a lot of work on some of these ideas going back to some co-written piece by Aníbal Quijano and Emmanuel Wallerstein on Americanity as a concept, right? That part of how coloniality comes into being with this engagement with the so-called New World, that it kicks off what in a sense becomes, you know, novelty as a temporal logic of modernity proper. So you have this obsession even with the idea that anything new is always already better, and then it translates into academic discourse what Barbara Christian, an African-American scholar, long ago wrote in a key essay called The Race for Theory, as this, you know, obviously play on the notion of race, because this was also happening with a lot of the theories coming out of ethnic and racial studies, that there's this race for who has the newest theory. Right, and all, it was a look into the political economy of the university, a look into the political economy of knowledge production, and how even there we're not devoid of the workings of coloniality, right? That even the process of knowledge production is itself also subject to this particular market and this particular logic that privileges to the point of obsession all things new, including the latest theory. So you now have academics that don't even really understand fully the history, the genealogy of where this work is coming from, and that are simply trying to engage it, publish, produce works, throwing around works like decolonial, decolonizing, this and that, for the sake of, you know, again, appearing as most hip or more adept to the newest theories, while losing sight of where these theories come from, right? And I think that's one thing that many of us that do engage with this decolonial turn realize, that most of this work comes out of struggle, right? Whether it be, you know, the likes of Fanon in Algeria, Martinique, or Aimé Césaire, or in the case, you know, I should add for your listeners that aren't familiar with Chicana and Chicano studies, in the U.S., what we call ethnic studies or Black studies, Chicano studies, you know, women's studies, queer studies, these are all departments that came directly out of the movements themselves. These were not departments that the university, the westernized university, suddenly said, let us open a department of Black studies, let us open a department of ethnic studies. No, these are spaces that were fought for and in essence taken over in order to, you know, bring the work from our communities, one, even the universities, to challenge those structures of knowledge on the one hand, but secondly, to say that it's time that the university is working truly in the service of our communities, right? So our fields are distinct than, say, even post-colonial studies or, more recent things such as area studies that sometimes gets confused in the U.S. context with ethnic studies. Area studies is a top-down, State Department funded, in the service of the state, fields that emerged in the Cold War, whereas ethnic Chicano and Chicano studies are from the bottom up in the service of the movements, in conjunction, walking with the movements. And so for us, that's how we remain grounded in the praxis, right? In the everyday life that gives rise to these theories. You know, I had some years back a Chicana scholar, Chela Sandoval, author of Methodology of the Oppressed. We invited her to one of the first iterations of the seminar, Decolonizing Knowledge and Power, in Spain, that we've been doing since 2009. And when Chela Sandoval asked me, well, why do you want me to come? What is this thing, coloniality, decoloniality, that you're doing? And how is it any different than what we as U.S. third world feminists were advocating in the 70s? And I looked Chela straight in the eye and I told her, you know what, Chela? There's nothing different about what we're doing. We make no pretensions to anything new. If anything, we're functioning within a context of the political economy of the university that privileges the new to create this name, coloniality, decoloniality, and our only pretension to a new theory is that our new theory is we need to deal with the unresolved shit. That is all. So we are doing exactly what you were doing in the 70s, and we're re-insisting on unresolved shit. When I put it to her that way, she said, sign me up. I'm there. I'll go. You know, and so for me, it's important, again, to make these connections to some of, in our case, in the case of the U.S., early ethnic studies, early U.S. third world feminists, both activism and scholarship, because what it was insisting on these conversations in an academic context to push back against the structures of knowledge that pit us in this position that would otherwise have us, you know, be folklore, culture, folk knowledge and not true academic knowledge.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually very interesting when you were just saying that how you connect experiences with the actions, with the words, with the engagements, with the knowledge sharing. And it was just when I was listening to you, parallelly, I was connecting with some aspects in India, especially with the socio-political scenario in India, when everybody is calling that we should go back to our traditions, we should go back to our indigenous roots and associations, and any kind of Western or westernized association should be given up. The very obvious question that comes up is, which indigenous root we are talking about? Because there is no one root. And there are multiple roots, and that comes with different communities, different religions, different lifestyles, different tribal communities, sects, subsects, sub-subsects, and it keeps on increasing. You keep on digging, you keep on moving inside. And at one point of time, what really disappoints me is that the decoloniality or decolonization, like many other theoretical dimensions, is becoming just a buzzword. You feel like you're cool, Okay, you wear a t-shirt with decolonization, you have a tattoo with decolonization, you write something on decolonization on the social media site and you use the term decolonization, you're cool. So, isn't this alarming, Roberto? What do you think? Isn't it alarming?
Yeah, but this is precisely what I mean, that you know, it's reproducing the very logic of modernity with this obsession to newness. So what I would actually insist on anybody that uses this language is to ask of them, well, what exactly are you decolonizing from? We need to have conceptual clarity on your diagnosis of the problem so that we could understand how it is, why it is that you're invoking such language, right? Because it's not enough to just throw around this word as this, you know, be it as a adjective, as a descriptor, prefix, what have you. It's not enough. We need conceptual clarity on how it is that you're invoking it and what it is you're decolonizing from. Because if you cannot articulate what you're decolonizing from, and it's just this abstract West, then I'm sorry, you're not decolonial. You know, and this is not a question of policing. This is a question of, you know, the nature of the work, if we're serious about actually decolonizing, which for me, right, I'll demand that of myself. I have to explain what I'm decolonizing from. For me, that presupposes an understanding of the problem affecting the world today being one of coloniality rather than colonialism. So first and foremost, we need conceptual clarity on the distinction between coloniality and colonialism. And secondly, you know, to be able to then say why it is that in this particular aspect of our everyday life, this notion of decoloniality or decolonizing is relevant, right? How exactly is it tied to, you know, the remnants or the ongoing processes of coloniality, right? So it's not enough to just throw it around, because then what we are doing is we're reproducing that logic that privileges all things new, you know, uncritically and just as de facto, making us hip, making us cool, you know, as opposed to really engaging the substantive nature of decolonizing from the grits of the modern colonial world, which is no easy task, and it is a process. And yes, you might, you know, especially in the context of indigeneity, you might dig and think you have an answer, but then the more you dig, it gets more complicated. And so I would say that the task is in the digging, right? It's in the questioning, not in the actual answers, but in the continual questioning. Because one of the things that for me is the biggest pet peeve, if you will, the moment I see anybody use the word not decolonial or decolonizing, but decolonized, with a pretension to have already affirmatively decolonized, whether it be language, whether it be culture, food, what have you. But a decolonized, what was it? I saw once a course that was listed, practicing a decolonized scholarship. Like, good, you know, good luck with that. That to me alone is already a red flag that they have no clue what they're talking about. And again, it's not about policing who has the right line, so to speak, but rather about, again, demanding rigor of ourselves. You know, that the times demand nothing less than thoughtful, humble, ethical, and rigorous engagement with both politics and the political. And by this, you know, I do not mean electoral meanderings, but a robust conception of politics and the political as that provided to us by someone like Argentinian Mexican philosopher Enrique Dulce, right, who has a different notion of the political, a different notion of politics, that even gives primacy to the political above and beyond the ethical, right? And he says politics is first philosophy, not ethics is first philosophy. Who do we even consider worthy of our ethical behavior is an a priori to that ethical question. See, and that for Dusalist politics, and to take that question seriously is to engage the decolonial.
Right, and to take this conversation further and to a more specific dimension, usually when we talk about decoloniality, decolonization, decolonialism, we often use the phrase unlearn to relearn or unlearning towards relearning. So my question is basically with this specific phrase. And what we are seeing is basically that decolonial practices underpinned with religious propagandas are often leading to religious and communal violence. Especially it has increased drastically in India. You find it in parts of West Asia as well. Or if you go into the continent of Africa, you go into different parts of Africa as well. So if we look into the caste and communal hierarchies, which are very much prevalent in India, then we can talk about the Islamic violence and violence against Islam in West Asia or parts of Africa. What we find is we find a very gross, confusing picture where indigeneity and the global modernity remains somewhere in conflict with each other. So don't you think that the decolonial perspectives of pluriversal thinking or the process of unlearning to relearn is often getting misrepresented, misinterpreted within certain socio-cultural contours?
Yes, misinterpreted, but I also would say that I don't think it's as much a matter of indigeneity and global modernity remaining in conflict with one another, but rather that there's, you know, a misinterpreted or corrupt sense of indigeneity that is itself already part and parcel of the logics of global modernity, and that it indeed is inheriting ideas of one land, one culture, one people, which is a modern practice, if you will, linked to a state mechanism. The first evidence of this, we see this on the Iberian Peninsula, right, with the expulsion of Muslims, Jews, and Gypsies alike. This is the beginnings of a conception of one nation, one people, one culture, one land that becomes then the model for the modern nation state. And so ironically, now we have people invoking this identity, this concept of indigenous or indigeneity, but in ways that are working through the logic of modernity. Right, so they're saying, no, we are the only people here, and engaging then in communal violence against other peoples, as opposed to, say, an engagement with coexistence, which is not to romanticize a pre-colonial past. Obviously, there's conflict and tension and violence there, too, but it occurs under different logics. It means to recognize that social relations and intercommunal relations operated differently, according to different logics, and that was the case before. And if that was the case before, it can certainly be the case again, right? This is where that unlearning to relearn is key, because we're right now still operating, even in the name of decoloniality, when we adhere to concepts of indigeneity, we might still be invoking completely modern colonial ideas of indigeneity. So more and more, I ask the question in my work, when we talk about indigenous or to indigenize, you know, I prefer to speak of populations as indigenized populations, right? Because they were never inherently indigenous. There's nothing about any population that makes them essentially indigenous, right? It's all populations are indigenized populations, and it's in and through that process of being indigenized that power was exerted on them. So how do you recognize yourselves not as an essentially indigenous person, but as a historically indigenized person with all the contradiction that entails? And then you could see that those who you don't see as indigenous might just be indigenized in a different way. Or in the case here in the Americas with a lot of mixed race populations, what arguably has happened, and this is where for me in Chicano studies has become key, is that the Chicano movement, what it was mixed race indigenous peoples that had been de-indigenized, re-indigenizing. So it gets kind of convoluted, right? So we're indigenized, de-indigenized, re-indigenizing. But now that re-indigenizing now is not is historically contingent on us understanding that the very process of having been indigenized was not an essential absolute, but a historical process. And then as was the de-indigenization. So what are we, what indigenous roots are we returning to? That has become a key point of contestation, because early in the Chicano movement, a lot of the reference points for Latinos in the US, especially those descended from Mexico, were the Aztecs. But that was a result of a Mexican nation state national project to push the idea of the Aztecs as the past of the nation. But we're not all Aztec, right? So many of us leaned in towards learning Aztec language, Nahuatl, Aztec cosmology. But then we find out, well, actually, you know, we start talking to our grandparents and our great grandparents and say, what are you talking about, Aztec? We come from the Wiradika people. We come from the Purepecha people. So we come become more knowledgeable through the digging, right? So it's in and through the process that we start to realize, okay, not everyone's Aztec. We got to dig deeper, right? And that's been, for us at least now, a process of 50 years. This year, we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of the creation of many of the Chicano studies departments, right? It's been a slow process, 50 years. Now, if we think in terms of coloniality and the long durée, we're just beginning, right? So we also understand that if it took us 500 years to get us to this point, we're not gonna undo this mess in you know, we're not one more conference away from the revolution, so to speak. It's gonna take a whole lot more digging, questioning, to be able to truly engage a praxis, right? That's the praxis, the digging itself.
Right. And also, that's a very interesting point you make, that we often assume that it's just a matter of a summer school or a conference or a workshop or just a book or a few research papers that will just help us to decolonize. But it's not that easy, because it's a very practical thing. And you have been talking about this aspect from the very beginning. But coming to the final question, now obviously, we have talked about so much of conflict, so much of problems within this very conception, within this very both concept and action of decoloniality. So the obvious question that comes right now is the demetaphorization of the concept of decoloniality. And you have talked in bits and pieces already. So can you come up with some more instances, some more examples, especially with respect to your engagements that you keep on doing on a regular basis, that how do you as an individual deal with this problem of metaphorization of decoloniality, which I think Tuck and Young has already talked about in their article about decoloniality is not a metaphor. And also this aspect is so relevant, that how to demetaphorize decoloniality, at least from your experiences, what do you think?
Reiterate, because I have mentioned, right, that we insist on conceptual clarity, that we insist that when anyone invokes notions of decoloniality, that they be able to address in a concise and clear manner, well, what exactly is it that you're decolonizing from? And if one cannot answer that And they have no business invoking such powerful language, such powerful rhetoric, and not, again, not as a question of policing them, who has the, you know, the right understanding of it, but because of that rigor that is called upon by the times we're in, you know. And so in a way, it's easier said than done, right? It's a process of unlearning, right? Ultimately, but I adhere to the idea that we can unlearn. You know, when my mother, growing up as a kid in Spanish, you know, if we're misbehaving, she would say, "Ah, pinche chamaco mal acostumbrado." So that translates roughly to like, "Oh, you're such a, you know, malaccustomed child." Right now, mind you, the language is malaccustomed, and that was important because you'd have other Mexican moms going around saying, "Ah, pinche chamaco hijo del diablo," which is like, "Oh, you damn child of the devil," and that's pretty common in our everyday language. But for me, it made me think, okay, if you're a child of the devil, then you are damned. There is no possibility of change. But if you're malaccustomed, hey, you could unlearn those customs and you learn new customs, right? So even in that slight difference in how she would scold me, nevertheless, there was a possibility of change, right? There's a possibility of doing otherwise, of changing how it is we approach our understandings of these things. Now, in my book, I do try in the conclusion to outline, in a sense, several theses for thinking about how, not so much to demetaphorize, but how to engage in the colonial, because I would say that ironically, even Tuck, in this essay that, you know, circulates so widely, they are working from an understanding of colonialism, not coloniality, and they reduce station to land. And those of us that are engaging decoloniality, you know, the decolonial turn, we know it's about more than just land. If it were simple to say colonizer go home, that'd be great. But it's not just simply that, right? We know that it's imbricated throughout the structures of knowledge.
Right. Right, yes.
I don't know if you froze here a bit, so I don't know that.
Yes, I mean, that's a very interesting point you have made. Yes, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes, yes. Sorry, it's because the screen seemed to have frozen for a bit, but you're moving again, so you're fine.
All right.
But yeah, so even Tug reduced their engagement to what I would say is colonialism proper and not to coloniality.
Right.
And so they're talking decolonization understood from a starting point of colonization. They're not talking about decoloniality. They're not even engaging coloniality in the way that, you know, people such as Quijano, Maldonado Torres, Mignolo, Roosevelt, Lugones, and others have engaged it. You know, so I would even go as far as to say that maybe they jumped the gun on that article for the sake of novelty and being the ones out there with that conversation, but they reduced it again to colonialism proper, not to coloniality. Yeah, so they're right. It's not a metaphor, but it's more than just simply land, and I think they enclosed it. At the risk of, you know, here unintended pun, right? They try to create a settled definition that I think is really problematic and has actually foreclosed more debate than it actually has opened.
Yes, I mean that's quite interesting, and I would like to. I hope that this I could continue with this conversation further. But surely we will continue for future episodes. And thank you so much, Roberto, once again for detailed sharing your thoughts about decolonialism, decolonization, decoloniality, what are the differences, what we should focus on, and how we can really overcome the fear or overcome the trap of, you know, getting into the trap of the metaphor of decoloniality rather than just a real action. Thank you so much once again.